So during the teaching, I usually say this praise to the Buddha, homage to the Buddha, which was done by Kono Lama Rinpoche, and I found it really good. And so So each day of teaching, Kono Lama Rinpoche said praise, a different praise to the Buddha. For example, the praise to the Buddha found in Sutra Alamkara and so forth. So I don't know as many as he did, many different prayers as he did. But Master Nagarjuna's praise to the Buddha in gratitude for his teaching of dependent origination is very marvelous. And so he's somebody we all revere very highly. And so I recite this praise to the Buddha. So the Heart Sutra, which we all recite, which says that by relying on this, the perfection of wisdom, all the Buddhas become enlightened and fully enlightened. So the past Buddhas, depending on what means and ways they became enlightened, is this the perfection of wisdom. And then those who are becoming fully enlightened are reaching that goal through this perfection of wisdom, and also the future Buddhas are going to become Buddhas through this perfection of wisdom. And so, how do we go about with the practice of the perfection of wisdom? Master Nagarjuna, in his Ratnavali, for if you wish to reach enlightenment for the sake of yourself and others, you should develop this mountain-like, the king of mountain-like bodhicitta. And great compassion and the non-dual wisdom. And so that factor, which if you have it, will lead to the omniscient state of Buddhahood, and which you, if you lack, will not lead you there, is bodhicitta, which holds others more important than oneself. More, and also in Sutra Alamkara, the root of that is asserted to be accepted to be compassion, and so compassion is the root of enlightenment, and all the different religious traditions emphasize compassion. But here we are referring to a great compassion, which is combined by the wisdom realizing emptiness. So the defilements and so forth that are within us can be overcome by application if we apply the antidote to them. While there is a possibility to overcome this, the cause of suffering, we are still constantly suffering, inflicted by suffering. As long as we have suffering, everyone will complain. For example, with regards to the changeable suffering, even the non-Buddhist traditions who cultivate and develop the samadhi do have this changeable suffering. And so within suffering, of course, there are different degrees of intensity. And so we do become frustrated with suffering, but then many beings actually indulge in the causes that lead to suffering. Therefore, what we need to do is we need to recognize what the causes of suffering and see that there is a possibility to overcome it through antidotes, and see the possibility to attain the cessation of the suffering and its cause. And so we should cultivate great compassion, which is this dedicated mind to liberate sentient beings from suffering and its causes. And so one should cultivate the dedication to shoulder and cultivate the dedication or determination to shoulder all the sufferings or to shoulder the responsibility to liberate all sentient beings from suffering and generate bodhicitta. And so in perhaps Haribhadra's Aloka, lamp, it is said that with wisdom, the bodhisattvas focus on enlightenment, and with compassion, they focus on sentient beings. And so, with the intention to reach that enlightenment, then you actually focus on serving sentient beings. And so, Master Nagarjuna says, bodhicitta, compassion, which is the root, and then to support them both, we have the wisdom realizing emptiness. We need to develop these three. And so, there's the determination to be free from samsara and compassion are the two sides of the coin. Like if you, when you have renunciation or the determination to be free, you are thinking about liberating yourself. Whereas when you turn that your mind towards others, you wish them to be out of suffering. And so, the Buddha first generated the Buddha, the bodhicitta, and then engaged in the bodhisattva. And so, after having cultivated the path, then the Buddha reached the path of accumulation, then path of preparation, path of seeing, and path of meditation, and then reached enlightenment, as referred by this mantra of Heart Sutra, Gate Gate, Paragate, Parasamgate, Bodhisattva. And so the Buddha was not like the Creator God, but in the beginning, he was like us, full of all negative emotions, the three poisons. And while he was under such condition, then he saw the fault of these negative emotions and then found searched for the antidote, the countermeasure to it, and then applied them, found them and applied them, and then became enlightened. And applying this antidote within oneself, and so, therefore, from his own experience, he has taught us, given us the teaching as to how to go about with overcoming the three poisons and reach enlightenment. And so we need to go, we need to follow suit. So in order to be able to do that, we first need to develop the three understandings, understanding arising through hearing, reflection, and meditation. And so we need first to engage in study and listening to the teaching. If you have a very broad knowledge, and then you'll be able to actually reflect on the meaning from a very broader perspective. Even if you may say, may I become a Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings, without really understanding much, then it will be just, of course, reciting the words, repeating the words, and there's not much effect. And so, from the point of view of the practices done by the bodhisattvas, who are of greater, sharper faculty, what they do is they go through the practice of equaling and exchanging self and others. And so for this practice of cultivating this kind of bodhicitta, there's no greater text than Master Shantideva's the Bodhisattvacharya Avatara. And so since the 8th century, there has not been any greater text for cultivation and training one's mind and bodhicitta than this. And so this is in turn, the source lies for Shantideva's text, the source lies in Master Nagarjuna's Ratnavali, Jewel Garland, and then also Master Nagarjuna's Bodhicitta Vivarana, which is a commentary on some lines from the Guhya Samaja Tantra. which says, devoid of all entities and so forth. And so the Bodhisattva is with sharper faculty develop bodhicitta through the means of equaling and exchanging self and others. Just as Chandrakshita says in his Madhyamaka Alamkara, first they find the wisdom realizing emptiness, and on the basis of that understanding and insight, then they go proceed to realize bodhicitta. So understanding of bodhicitta, understanding of emptiness comes first, and then with the help of that, these bodhisattvas, those who have this kind of lineage, see to develop bodhicitta. So so when you understand emptiness, then you'll be able to see the possibility to overcome the delusions and so forth, and then you will see the truth in the teaching of the Buddha to reach enlightenment and cessation and so forth, and you will find a very deep admiration and faith in the Buddha based on reason. So for those of sharper faculty within the follower of Buddhism, perhaps they first realize emptiness and then see the quality of the teaching of the Buddha, and then they develop their faith in the Buddha. Perhaps they perhaps before even taking refuge in the Buddha, they would have realized emptiness, and that helps perhaps to have some understanding of emptiness would help them to develop wisdom. The taking refuge in the Buddha, therefore, for such person, the understanding of emptiness really helps for them to develop the path. So what I'm saying is that Bodhisattva Charavatara and the six texts by Nagarjuna use lots of reasoning to explain the different teachings. And the more reason you have, the more broader your mind would be, and that would be give you greater force to combat with the self-cherishing attitude and grasping at self and grasping at true existence. Otherwise, just saying, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, may I be able to reach Buddhahood and so forth, may not be so strong. And if so, therefore, it is very important to have very broad learning. So, of course, you may read lots of books, but there may be many books that you may read to develop, understand, to have knowledge, but we need all to develop, study Master Dhammakirti's texts, such as Brahmanavartika and so forth, to bring admiration and faith and so forth, based on reason. So Tibetan Buddhist tradition has this tradition of studying this text on logic and epistemology, which is not there in the other Buddhist traditions. So not only do we study the Indian texts on logic and epistemology, but we also have Tibetan masters writing commentaries and their own texts on logic and epistemology, such as Sajya Pandita's Treasury of Reasoning and so forth. And those in the past, the Sakya tradition has much learning of logic and epistemology. And then later on, the Gelug tradition, started with Tsongkhapa. And so in these traditions, we have the different texts studied, classic texts, such as in the Sakya tradition, they talk about 13 different classics. And then we usually also refer to the five canonical texts, literature, And then in the Peiyu tradition also, they have many different classic texts, such as the 18 great treatises and so forth. And so, as I usually say, the Tibetan Buddhism is the tradition of Nalanda. So we have the 17 Nalanda masters' writings, which we memorize, and then, as I already said yesterday, we study the commentaries to them and through rigorous study and through dialectical debate, putting them in these texts to rigorous examination, and in this way we preserve and promote the Nalanda tradition. Especially in the great monastic institutions like the Densasum and so forth. You have been doing this. And so in the beginning, after we came into exile here in South India, you lived, the monks at that time lived in bamboo sheds. I also had stayed in bamboo sheds. It was quite cool to stay inside. You can actually have the breeze blowing through the walls. And so again, Pema Gelsen and Yen Shao Kimberche, and then also other abbots really were dedicated to put up with all the hardships and pass on this lineage. And Gingeron Kensul here, and so forth. So they really worked hard to give education to the monastics. So even the students were quite good ones, only few of them, but so I had said at that time, so you have the opportunity to, you have this opportunity to study under such great masters like these. So I also had thought that I didn't have the time, but I also wished that I could stay amongst them and continue with my studies more. But of course, it's a really great tradition that we have. But the generations are changing now, and we have new generation of monks. And as time changed, we had more and more number of monks coming out from Tibet and joined these monastic institutions. And then they have done their studies, they do their studies here and then become geishas, or maybe some of them may not have done geisha degree, but there are people who have gone back to their own birthplace back in Tibet and started a study of the classic texts on philosophy and so forth where they didn't exist, and then also developed the study further where it already existed, and also introduced Buddhism to the general public. So they have really been done a great a contribution to the Dharma in these ways. So your study of Dharma is not only for your own for living your own life, but as we say in this prayer of the Lamrim, and so where the Dharma has spread before and is declined, and where it has not spread before, and may I, moved by compassion, illuminate the Dharma. And so, as Master Tsongkhapa makes this prayer, you should do this. So I'm not in these monastic institutions permanently, but you are here, and therefore the students should take the responsibility to preserve and promote the Dharma further. And so we have less number of teachers, qualified teachers these days, so the new younger generation, of course, should strive to become qualified teachers, to continue this tradition of educating younger monks. And so you have been born as Tibetans and then became monks and joined these institutions. And you are taking the responsibility to preserve and promote Dharma. And I would like to thank you all who are dedicated in this venture. So whether I'm in Dharamsala or in other parts of the world, I always feel confident that still these three densasum, the three seats of learning, are still the study of these classic texts are going on very well. And so all of you have done really well so far, and I wish to request you to continue to do so. So I usually say that regarding the Tibetan struggle, it's a struggle between the power of truth and power of gun. So, of course, the power of gun on the immediate level is very, very powerful. But in the long run, the power of truth will prevail over the power of gun. So we have been in exile for nearly 60 years now. So if we take into account 1949 or 50, then it's been over 60 years we have been under suppression. And so people inside Tibet, the spirit in them, the spirit of Tibetan spirit is very strong. And so with regard to the power of truth, we have Chinese brothers and sisters amongst intellectuals, artists, writers, and there are many who are really supportive of our cause, just cause, and they really take responsibility. They feel this enthusiasm to take some responsibility for the Tibetan just cause. And so in the last 3 to 4 or 5 years, there had been over 200 articles written in Chinese from the mainland China. And then from outside of China, there had been about 800 or so articles. So in all, there are over 1,000 articles. All of these actually are supportive of our struggle, our position, which is the middle way for mutual benefit, and not seeking one side's defeat and one side's victory. So this is indication of the power of truth, that they support us. It's very difficult to say that they are afraid of Tibetans, so they see the truth on our side, and therefore support us. And so our truth on the sun will shine for Tibet in the end. And so the strong determination and integrity and spirit of Tibet, the Tibetan spirit, is still there. So we have the richest Buddhist tradition in Tibetan language, so the central Tibetan, and then the Dotu and Dome areas, the Tibetans are still. Although there may be individual Tibetans who have no faith, no belief in religion, like such as Baba Phunzo Wangyal and Yangling Dorje, they are all communists. They don't have any belief in religion. But they are really strongly dedicated to the Tibetan spirit. They have a very strong Tibetan spirit. And so this comes from the Tibetan Buddhism. So on the other hand, if you wonder whether our Dharma has actually helped the political situation or not, so since 8th and 9th centuries, Tibet remained quite fragmented, and there has not been a time when all the whole of Tibet has been united. So today, the whole of Tibet is united by Tibetan Buddhism. And so, of course, it's not political in itself, but then it has helped our political situation. And so our treasure, whether we call it our treasure or our unique heritage, it is this Buddhist philosophy. And so I make these three distinct categories of Buddhist science, Buddhist philosophy, and then Buddhist religion. And so this, regarding the science and the philosophy aspect of Buddhism, it can be universal, be applicable. And Buddhist religion, of course, is meant for Buddhists alone. And so it may not cover even all the Buddhists as well. And so the Buddhist science and Buddhist philosophy are something that can be very beneficial to the whole world. And therefore, I usually have been making these three categories within the content of the Ganjur and Tenjur. So Buddhist science, Buddhist philosophy, and Buddhist religion. And so since over 2.5 years, we have I've been asking people to compile some book. And so many of the scholars know this. You have actually engaged in this project. And so in the new year, or in the Tibetan New Year, these books will be published. And so these will be something that through which we can actually make a contribution, effective contribution to the world. So as I said earlier, we have this practice of making tormang offerings and toryak and also certain practices, yantras and so forth, to overcome evils. But after having done them for centuries, we finally became refugees and had to live a very, very sad, poor life in the beginning. And then in Tibet, we used to have this custom of doing some ritual practice during the summer and winter solstices. And so the Tibetan government in those days also spent lots of money and lots of resources for such prayers. And not only this, but also others. And so we had really spent so much time and energy and resources for these kind of rituals. So we had leaders and rulers and then subjects and so forth who were ruled. But then in the end, when we had to come into exile, we all came as the same people, and we had no differences, as we have the saying in Tibet. And so, to be frank, the 13th Dalai Lama sent some Tibetans to study in England. Why it didn't become successful? It was because the abbots of the Densasum were against this project that the 13th Dalai Lama started to educate Tibetans in modern subjects, English and so forth. Considering that the Westerners were our enemies. But these days, our scholars all run towards Western countries. So I have lived quite a long life now. So many of the mistakes are our own doing because of our complacence, our negligence. So what gives us some kind of a solace is this Nalanda, pure Nalanda tradition that we have preserved so far. So this is something that we need to be proud of. And so in Lamrim Chemo, Dzongkhapa says, the purpose of having studied is to practice, and therefore it is important to apply whatever you have studied into practice. And so we study the collected topics, and in which we learn the procedure of debating, and then we go on with the study of others. So these are meant for understanding the reality of how things are. And then we also study other topics like causality, and relationships and contradictions and so forth. And these are actually teaching us how to see reality. And therefore, the teachers must introduce to the students that the purpose of their study is for actually continuing their studies into practice. And so there was one Shatsa Geshe and Chadal and so forth in the past. So right from the beginning of the study of Parchin, the study of Prajaparamita texts, they have actually taken these studies for the purpose of applying this teaching of the Buddha within themselves, and not just thinking that, oh, they will do first the study and then later on practice. So Drum Dumba has said that while studying, I also combined reflection and meditation. While reflecting, I combined study and meditation. And while meditating, I combined also study and reflection. And I am an impartial Kadampa. And so, right from the beginning, the teachers must introduce their students to how to apply these teachings for their own practice to make transformation. And so, in the commentaries on the Perfect Inner Wisdom teachings, we sometimes find instructions, exhortations while making commentaries. Intermittently, there are these instructions by like Jetsa Dhamma Rinchen and so forth. So we need to understand that the purpose of these instructions is to actually let us know that these are studies are meant for our practice. So I had some people who had actually come to me and asked for clarifications of some points that are found in the Parchin and Uma text. And I told them that you have studied Parchin and Uma, the Prajaparamita text studies and Madhyamaka's text, and what more do you really need to find some points for your understanding and gaining understanding through practice other than these texts? And so there had been some kind of complacency on our part that these texts are not really meant for our practice. And so I see this tendency there. And so we need to introduce to the students that these texts are meant for practice. So that they are, and so right from the beginning of our studies, starting with the collected topics up to the higher study, we should always make the students to see with themselves in perspective, and that these are meant for cultivating the determination to be free from samsara, renunciation, compassion, bodhicitta, and understanding of emptiness, and even the tantric practices are meant for these. And so it is better for us to point our own mistakes rather than having others to point them out for us. And then by pointing our own mistakes, we should make changes. And therefore, we should not be complacent. And I always say that the abbots should be very strong in their deliberation in their own monasteries. And I have also been saying we have already talked about really making the Gaden Tripa institution to be stronger and more effective, so that the Gaden Rinpoches could actually take greater responsibility and be more effective in making changes and making corrections and so forth. So we should not wait until some kind of mistakes have been made, found to have been made during such and such, during the tenure of such and such abbot and so forth. So, during each tenure of an abbot, if there is a difference in the quality and the standard of education of the monastics, then during the tenure of some abbots, if they're better, and during the other tenure of other abbots, it's worse, then that's not really good. And so we are talking about preservation and promoting the Buddha Dharma, and therefore we need to see where we were lacking in the past and how we need to actually mend that, and then also where we need to add more to what we already have, such as this study of science now is already added to our curriculum, which is very good. And so in the past, there were abbots who even didn't know how to sign their own names. And so we need to see that we are able to make this Nalanda tradition that we have an all-round study institution, like in the past, Nalanda used to be a study center for all kinds of disciplines that were existing, that existed in India. And so it would be good if we could also make this our institutions like that. So we have many people from many different countries, like Mongolians and so forth, who take interest and come to study Buddhist philosophy here. And so we are, of course, we have been making contributing to the world through this, the study that we do in these monastic institutions. So we still need to do further. So in many different parts of the world, we have Buddhist centers of the Sakya, Nyingma, Geluka, Yu, and even the Bun, and so which is very good. But the teachers in these centers, come from these monastic institutions, the great monastic institutions, like Namdo Ling Monastery also, which was reestablished by Benno Rinpoche here, who was very dedicated to do that. And he used to tell me that in the past that some Dzogchen masters have told him that they were displeased for him to have started the study of the academic study of great classic texts through dialectical debate, but he actually persisted to set up these teachings and continue it. And so when I was in Namdo Ling last time, I told them, the monks there, they do study Parchin and then Uma, the study of Pragyaparamita and Middle Way. And also I told them to have the study of Tattuv Samgraha by Chandrakshita. the great treatise on logic and epistemology, and also its commentary on called the Commentary on Difficult Points by Kamala Shila. I actually suggested them, and they have a 9-year study program, and on top of that, if they could actually specialize in their monastery, the study of these two texts by Shanta Rakshita and Kamala Shila, the son and the father and the son, and I suggested this, thinking that it would be good. And then in Dharamsala at the Institute of Dialectics, also I also suggested to study this text by Shanta Rakshita. His Holiness is looking for the deputy director of IBD, Gesang Damdil, I think. So we had talked earlier to actually include this study of Shanta Rakshita's text, and you told me that it is very difficult text. Yes, that's true. I also read it, and it is very difficult. But if we say it's very difficult and then leave it aside, then who will actually take care of this text? In the end, if everything that is difficult to be left aside, then there may be come a time when people would say, oh, this is so difficult, we are not able to study in it, let's just burn this. So this is what I wanted to say, and I suggested the Namjoo Ling to have these. And so during the time of the Jetsong Kapa, he actually had taught, there was this tradition of teaching the Abhisamaya Alamkara together with the 21 different commentaries, the Indian commentaries. And also we should include in the study of Madhyamaka, Bhaviveka's text, Dagrajivala and so forth, so that we are able to see really his own viewpoint, how he criticizes the Buddha Palita, and whether his criticisms are actually striking home or not, and how Chandrakirti actually refutes his position and his criticisms and so forth, could become really clear to us. And so, in short, what I was saying was that it's very important to study, to reflect and meditate. And so these are being really done well in these great monastic institutions. We have many Ladakhis in these monastic institutions. One of them is here, the Gyekwe, this discipline master. So in this assembly, we have a Ladakhi in the top seat, and then on top of the row here next to me, and then also we have a Ladakhi down there, the discipline master of Sarache. And then we also have another Ladakhi, or Sanskari. You have been really, really helpful dedicated, worked hard to bring Ladakhis into these monastic institutions to have more students. So the Ladakhis, because they have come from such a high land, when they first got here, they said, now we are in this hot climate, very close to the ocean, and they were actually complaining because of this wet, the climate here. And so you have done really well to bring these students here in the beginning. So we are on page 125 in this new book. When you take refuge in them, the three jewels have the ability to protect you from suffering in the lower realms, but you wonder what kind of causes you must produce to attain high rebirth. So the main thing is to train oneself in the 10 virtuous actions and the discipline or the morality of the precept of avoiding the 10 non-virtuous actions and then take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And then the Tathagata himself, of course, have gone through the training over three countless eons. We also make this prayer that we may we be able to offer this body, our body, speech, and mind, and also wealth and resources, without any sense of loss to all sentient beings. So Shaman Lamrim has a very good explanation of this verse. Shaman Lamrim is a very good text, and it has also it touches on the difficult points and explains them more in good detail. You should contemplate black and white karma, and so please read through. Identify sinful and virtuous deeds individually, and reflect on the ways of karma's growth, on the fact that you cannot experience a result of karma that you have not accomplished, that one has accomplished. Karma does not go wasted. On this basis, you should thoroughly reject ill deeds and accomplish virtuous assets. This cannot be verified by direct reasoning. Refer to scripture, such as King of Concentration Sutra, which says this verse. Having cultivated profound faith in the form of conviction in relation to the Buddha's words, recall the following. And so mainly here, we have to gain conviction through what is known as the scriptures, which are devoid of, free from three faults, when we actually do critical analysis or examination of the words of the Buddha. And then in the Mahayana texts, and it is said that we need to make this distinction between literal, definitive, and interpretable teachings of the Buddha. As Master Tsongkhapa says in his distinction between definitive and the interpretable meanings of the sutras, one who actually goes against reasoning cannot become an authoritative or authentic person. And someone who asserts some concepts that are against reasoning. And so if it is true that if we cannot go against reason, then how can we go against something which is obvious? For example, in the case of... that's why I always say that the Mount Meru, as it is taught in the Abhidhamma text, cannot be accepted. Because it is said that the shadow is experienced by us, but if the shadow is experienced by us, how come the source of that shadow from which it comes is not accessible to us? And so here, while we may say that the shadow is something which we can experience, which is obvious object for us, our perception, but then the object from which the shadow comes is not perceptible to our senses. How come we can make such as claims? And so even the birds, when they are scared to stay outside, and when it becomes dark, and therefore they go back to their nests. So we can say that we can use the reasoning where we can say that if something were to be perceptible and if it is not perceived, then we can actually reject its resistance. So when we actually criticize non-Buddhist traditions and others' positions, then we use such logic. And when it comes to our own belief systems, if we can not use the same logic but hold on to what is totally against our perception, then we cannot become authoritative or authentic people. And so you can see the reason why I reject the Mount Meru. as it is taught in the Abhidhamma text. So conviction in relation to Buddha's words. So just by taking that something to be the Buddha's words as the reason, then the Buddha also has an old monks and scholars examine my teaching thoroughly and then accept it, not out of your devotion. So if we were to go only by the account that it is said that by the Buddha, then the Buddha has said so many different things. Sometimes he has taught Buddha selflessness, and at other times he also has taught as if there is a self separate from the aggregates. And therefore, if we have to accept both, then it's inconsistent. And then there are sutras, Chittamatra sutras. So Buddha has actually taught these sutras, which teach Chittamatra view. And so if we were to actually take all of these words of the Buddha to be literally, then there's no reason why Master Nagarjuna and so forth have made this distinction between an interpretable and the definitive teachings of the Buddha. And therefore, so we should. So with regard to the obvious things, they should not be contradicted by direct sense perception, and then the slightly hidden ones should not be contradicted by inference, and then the very hidden ones should not be contradicted by authoritative scripture. And so we need to think along these lines and then make these distinctions and find faith and conviction in the Buddha. So with regard to the very subtle workings of karma, there are cases of very hidden phenomena. And so I always say this. For example, our date of birth, each of us do not know it by ourselves. We need to rely on someone whom we consider as authoritative. So I was born, for example, said to be born on the 6th of July, 1935. So of course, I cannot know it by myself. But my mother and people who were around there, then, I mean, I have to rely on their words. So there's no way I can actually do any kind of analysis, critical inferential analysis into it. Therefore, I have to take their words to be true. And so, first of all, we need to see that the person whom we rely on is someone who is very stable. He must be a witness, he or she must be a witness to it. And there's no reason why he or she should tell a lie. And also, with regard to other points, other things, the person also has been really reliable. And therefore, with regard to this particular, point, I can also take this, the person, to be reliable. And so similarly with regarding the words of the Buddha, as we said, there are the two goals of higher rebirth and definite goodness. So the means or to attain this higher definite goodness ultimately is the understanding or the teaching on dependent origination. And this cannot be contradicted by reason. And not only that, it is also supported by valid knowledge. And therefore, the Buddha's teaching, so in such thing, can be taken as authoritative. Nothing is hidden from his perception. So this is a unique quality of the Buddha as well. So in the Sakya tradition, we have the authoritative scripture, authoritative of shastras, authoritative master, and authoritative experience. So first we have the authoritative scriptures, and then the authoritative scripture, the treatises, and then the lamas who have actually developed the experience depending on these scriptures and the treatises, and then we have the experience of that comes to oneself. So this is the chronological order how these come down to us. Whereas when it relates to an individual like us, first we need to develop the experience of the teachings, and then through that we can see that our masters are actually authentic, and the teachings that they have relied on and studied, reflected, and meditated upon, such as the great treatises, are seen as authoritative and authentic. We can also sometimes feel that when we read texts like Nagarjuna and so forth, and we can actually feel something is there. So with regard to this cherishing others, bodhicitta, it actually combats this self-cherishing attitude. But as we do not have the experience of emptiness, I mean, it doesn't really seem to that this can actually help us to combat the negative emotions. I'm not saying that I've realized emptiness, but I still hope to reach the level of realization of emptiness. So when I read these texts, by the classic texts, I always feel that, oh, this is what I also understand, and so forth. So I don't remember what Ngoto Thonyi had said, and I discussed with him. Oh, okay. So because of the teaching on dependent origination, you do not resort to these extreme views. And this is an impeccable reason to see your authoritativeness. Teaching of the Buddha. So I recite these lines from Mula Madhyamaka Karika. Whatever is dependent on reason is said to be empty, and that in turn is dependently designated, and that is the middle path. And so I always recite it, and I also reflect on the meaning of these lines. As Jerome Boucher says, by seeing the profound dependent origination in relation to the Buddha. So the term profound here is an indication of the suchness of dependent origination. So the 24th chapter is the main chapter of the Mula Madhyamaka Karika, and then these two verses, which the first one is already what I had recited, and the next one is whatever is there's nothing which is not dependently arisen, and therefore there's nothing which is not empty. And so when you really think about this, then it really gives so much inspiration and influence in your mind, to such an impact in your mind in a good way, that you can actually, when you having understood, having brought up this understanding within yourself, when you look out in the world, you can see that they do appear as if they have some, things do have some, appear in the way they have some kind of dependent on objective existence, but they do not have such a way of existence. And then when you have this kind of slight experience, then you can also feel great gratitude to your gurus. And you can see the authoritativeness of the reliability of the gurus. And then you will see also the reliability and of the masters Nagarjuna and so forth, their texts. And also you can feel quite strongly passionate about them as well. And then also the Buddha through that, as it is said by Nagarjuna, I pay homage to the Buddha, the best of speakers, who has taught whatever is dependently arisen is not coming, not permanent, not annihilated, and so forth. And so what I'm referring to in terms of experience is a very ordinary experience. As you develop further and further, you will have a deeper experience. Through that, you'll see that your master to be valid, and then through that, you'll see the treatises to be valid, and then through them, the words of the Buddha to be valid. And so this is how we should go about when it comes to talking about cultivating profound faith in the form of conviction in relation to Buddha's words. Recall the following passage. Then the next verse, page number 126, the root of all kinds of goodness is faith. This is what the Muni taught, and so forth. In general, you should reject all non-virtues, and in particular reflect the maturation effects of 10 physical, non-verbal, and mental non-virtues, great, average, lesser, and so forth. Next verse, the chapter of truth says, O king, do not kill, for all sentient beings it is their life that they hold dearest. Therefore, if you wish to continue living a long time, do not contemplate killing, even in the back of your mind. As explained here, thoroughly cultivate the intention to abstain from killing and so forth, and do not let even the thought to do ill arise in you. You must strive to accomplish all forms of virtue as well, abstention from taking life and so forth. To quote Jay Rinpoche, it is not certain that after death you will not be reborn in lower realm and so forth. So this passage is written, read. So whether we are going to be reborn in the next life or not, the final decision comes is dependent on the state of mind at the time of dying. So when you are about to die, at that point, the mind, if it is influenced by strong attachment and anger, then there is great danger. Even if you may not have been able to do good practice, but if you are able to bring up a very strong virtuous state of mind at that time, then it can help you to have a higher rebirth. So I always have this confidence that I will reflect on bodhicitta at that point of time in my life. And so we are all going to die sooner or later. But mainly, apart from doing all the rituals and so forth, if you could focus your mind on bodhicitta and the understanding of emptiness, if you can also, then but you can read Master Nagarjuna's, Master Chandideva's Bodhisattva Charya Avatara to reflect on these, and it will be really, really beneficial at the time of death. It is not certain after death and so forth. This will depend on thoroughly on pondering black and white karmas and their effects, and on successfully rejecting the former and accomplishing the latter. By observing the ethics of abstention from the non-virtuous, you'll attain a good rebirth. However, to realize supreme omniscience, you also need to be born as a good family with a pleasant physique and so forth. In other words, you must ensure that you have the eightfold maturation qualities. This is by refraining from harming. And so, by offering lights and new clothes, so we do these practices and overcoming pride and expecting others and so forth. So relying on remembrance of vigilance and vigilance, you should follow this instruction. So if you look in the world, we see all kinds of people who in their wish to gain more wealth and resources, actually deceive others, be dishonest, and so forth. So if you are surrounded by such people, they may also influence you. So we have to be careful. So instead, restore your pledges in the ways that corresponds to the kind of transgressions that you have committed. So confess your sins with all the four remedial forces and strive to ensure that misdeeds and transgressions do not taint you. And then Jerembuche's verse. Once through meditation, you have turned from preoccupation with this life and generated spontaneous concern for the excellent future life. Your training in the lesser being's path will have been successful. So in the four ways of turning mind away from attachment, if you are attached to samsara, there's no renunciation. If you are attached to selfishness, there's no bodhicitta. And if there is fixation, there's no view of selflessness. If you're attached to this life, there's no renunciation. And so, of course, the practice of based on the understanding of causality is there, even in the non-Buddhist traditions like Hinduism, Indian non-Buddhist traditions, as well as Christianity and so forth. So if you're really sincere about your own different religions, you have these practices in all religious traditions. In Ladakh, once I was in Turtuk, in Nubra region, so they said that in the past, they were actually subjects of the Tibetan government. So during the time of the kings, ancient kings, they were. So one time I met a former foreign minister of Kyrgyzstan, and with some of his co-workers, they brought a picture of Om Mani Padme Hum inscribed on a stone. This mantra, and the handwriting was very, the inscription was very clear. And so they found it on top of some coffin that they had dug out in Kyrgyzstan. So they called Tibet in the past Tibet. So they find in their old documents the mention of Tibet as being one of the countries in the past. And so this inscription of the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum in Tibetan was found in their country. So it seems that our emperors and had influence in these regions. And so in Turtuk in Ladakh, near Nubra, he told and said that Muslims actually respect and submit themselves to Allah. And then he said, they also need to respect all the creatures of Allah as well. So there is a reason, isn't there? So the more you actually respect Allah, the more you should also take care of the creatures of Allah. So that's what he said. So in the recent because of some developments in the world today, some people actually criticize Islam as being really negative, and because of few misbehaving Muslims. So I was in the commemoration of the September 11th incident in Washington in a Christian monastery, the Christian church, cathedral. And so at that I said that some people consider that there is a clash between the Western civilization and the Islamic civilization, saying that the Islam is against democracy. And so there are also scholars who have written such books. And because of the destruction of the two because of few mischievous people, Muslims, I said that we should not actually generalize the whole of Islam to be bad, discriminate against them. Mischievous people are there in Christians, amongst Christians, Jews, Hindus, and amongst Tibetans. So because of few mischievous people, if we generalize the whole of these religious traditions, then it's not right. So all the religious traditions which teach love and compassion, and of course if the followers sincerely practice these, then there's also the practice of tolerance, forgiveness, the avoiding the ten, the first nine non-virtuous actions. And then with regard to the wrong view, of course, we can explain and interpret it according to the different religious traditions in context to the to their own philosophical concepts. So these ten practice of the abstention of the ten non-virtuous actions is something very common to all traditions. So whether these practices become Muslim practice, Islamic practice, or Christian practice, or Buddhist practice, they need to be complemented by the practice of taking refuge in either interaction in Islam, to Allah, to and God in Christianity, and then the three jewels in the case of Buddhism. So Tsongkhapa says that the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha has taught it everywhere in his teaching. And understanding this is very essential to understand the whole, the complete structure of the Buddhism. And so one should introduce one's students to the Buddha Dharma through these Four Noble Truths. As said, this is what I do, that's why. And Master Tsongkhapa says that may I find the Buddha to be authoritative by understanding his teaching, the nature of his teaching. And therefore, if you really check the teaching of the Buddha with your own experience, of course, there is some kind of experience would be there in the practitioners of Christianity and Islam and so forth. So I had a friend, a Christian friend, many years ago, and I met him one time, and he said his prayer, which is a hymn to the Lord. And while he was actually saying the prayer, he was tears trickled down his cheek. And so when you have this kind of strong sense of giving in to your own God or something, then of course these things happen. You can also see around these Tibetan villages in the settlements, some Christian nuns working for very poor, needy families in India. So I want to tell, can I tell this story to you? So there's a leader of an Italian autonomous region, South Tyrol region. So I heard that he was sick just recently. And one time he came to Mundugod, and so he saw the Tibetan settlement there. And then after that he went to Bangladesh, and he saw Christian practitioners living in very poor villages and working for the health and education of the village. And some of them told him that they are Tibetans. So some of his colleagues had said that, told him that the Tibetan Buddhists are actually living beside all these Indians who were really poor, whereas and they are not working in those Indian villages, whereas the Christians actually are working for these Bangladesh poor people and villages in these regions. So I have already suggested before that if we really build grand buildings, of course this money that come from sponsors who actually think that they're helping us, poor Tibetans. So we should really consider and rethink about building grand buildings, and where because where we are living is besides these Indian villages, which are very poor. So then with regard to building huge statues of Buddhas and other masters, one time in Revalsar, of course, I went to I went there where there was there is this huge statue of Guru Padmasambhava, and I told during the teaching, I said, of course, I respect Guru Rinpoche, and I said, this statue may remain for 1,000 years, but it will not speak to us. Whether it's hot, it'll just stand there. And if it's cold, it'll still remain smiling. And even if some birds land on its head and drops its droppings on its head, and the statue will remain like this. So we have these texts which we should not just leave in the altar, but read, frequently read them, and also think about the meaning, and also meditate frequently. So when it comes to studying Lam Rim Chima, for example, and many times what happens is until the point where we reach the insight part, people read them a lot, and the pages of the scripture also get worn out. But when it comes, when we reach the insight part, the pages remain rather clean. So we really need to read these. And so we should read the parts of pertaining to brings of intermediate great scope, and then the shamatha part, and also the Lakdong insight part, because Jetsong Kapa really goes into more and more greater detail as he goes down and explaining these different aspects of the practices. So some lamas write very extensively as it becomes more and more difficult. As they go into more and more difficult points, the explanations are thinner and shorter and shorter. And so Jerembuche is not like that. With regards to, for example, identifying the object of negation to understand and gain insight into emptiness, he has done it very in great detail in the Great Insight section of Lam Rim Chemo. So what other book could we actually find than this one? in great detail. So with regard to 10 virtuous, non-virtuous actions, abandoning 10 non-virtuous actions, these are something common to all religious traditions. Read through the book, please. Training the mind on the path shared with intermediate beings. Although you attained an excellent high rebirth by rejecting the 10 non-virtuous actions and adopting 10 virtues, you have yet to eliminate samsaric suffering. For that reason, it is necessary to attain liberation by which you overcome samsara's misery entirely. So it's not sufficient just to say you need to attain this nirvana, but whether you should check whether it is possible or not. And especially whether it's possible for you to attain it not or not. And so the reasons that are used, the reasonings that are used in Brahmana Vartika by Dhammakirti are very good. And that alone is not sufficient. We also need to use the reasonings found in Madhyamaka texts as well. So Lobin Master Bhavaviveka, of course, was a great Madhyamaka philosopher. Although he did, accepted the objective existence in things. And then we have Master Chandrakshita, who has also written Madhyamaka texts, and also Tatov Samgraha, the great treatise of logic and epistemology. And then Kamala Shila also has written the Madhyamaka text and also text on logic and epistemology. And so we should combine these two, Madhyamaka tradition and the logic and epistemology tradition, the Brahmana tradition. And for this, you may wonder what the suffering of each level of samsara are, and those of the three lower realms are explained above. In the present context, however, your reflections on these should be more thorough than before. After contemplating the woes of those lower realms individually, you can feel, how could I possibly bear that kind of intense suffering for such long periods of time? I must do all that I can do to free myself from suffering of samsara, as exemplified these. By these. In fact, you are subject to samsara's nature of suffering at all levels, low and high, and not just in the lower realms. Please read through the text. After delivery, though, you are placed on this very soft bed, it hurts as much as being thrust into a mass of thorns. Thus, you experience the unbearable pain of birth. Once born, you progressively grow up, and before you know it, it's begin to age. Your back bends like a bow. Your hair becomes as white as trava flower. And so with regards to this suffering of aging, Gongdang Tenpe Duemi's book and text, which is short, would be very good. Which is a conversation between an old man and a young man. And then when you sit, it is as though a back strap had been snapped, and rising is like tearing up roots and so forth. So when your body's elements are unbalanced and upset, now we are into this power. The suffering of pain, sickness, and then also suffering of going through the dying stages.
Senoso,
The last paragraph in on page 128, as for the heart is not achieving the goals you have set. For a householder, this may consist in endeavoring to farm only to see that crops fail due to drought, frost, hail, and so on. In boats, you may face difficulties with the wind and so forth. In trade, you may lose your merchandise or fail to make a profit when you are monastically. So they constitute the pain of failed aspirations. So the five aggregates are the nature of some suffering. So in the Namrim Chemo, there are an enumeration of eight different sufferings, beginning with this kind of suffering, down to the suffering because of the five aggregates. So once you have taken birth with appropriate aggregates, on their basis you experience all the misery of this life, illness, aging, death, and so on. Moreover, they induce the trials of future lives. You become a vessel for manifest suffering, for the suffering of change, and have the nature of all purpose of suffering. In other times, the aggregate's nature is exclusively one of suffering, lacking even the minor kinds of happiness. The demigods experience extremely violent pain when, for example, their bodies are chopped up and torn to pieces as the signs of impending death effect. Desire rams gods, the torment they experience is even greater than hell ring. And then the suffering of the gods of the Diana, the form realms, and then also the suffering of the gods of formless realms. You cannot achieve liberation without producing its causes. Consequently, you must earnestly implement the three trainings that constitute the method to attain liberation, because the latter two trainings require a base. You must first cultivate the higher training of ethical discipline. As ignorance is the main reason for transgression occurrence, with vigilance and remembrance, observe yourself attentively and first be careful not to commit transgressions. If they do occur, do not keep them long, instead confess them thoroughly. Meditate energetically on the antidotes to your major clashes and ensure that you are not tainted by transgression and that nothing that you do is ever in conflict with our guide's teaching. In this way, you will not let yourself down. Quote Jai Rinpoche. So, without endeavoring to reflect on the true sufferings, drawbacks, not real aspiration, no real aspiration to liberation will ever arise. So it's not sufficient just to say, may I become liberated, may I achieve liberation, because you have to understand how to go out of this samsara. As Mahat Nagarjuna says, eliminating karma and afflictive emotions, there is liberation, nirvana, and karma and delusions arise from mental fabrications, and that fabrication is dissolved by emptiness. And so the reading of this third line could be, and they in turn come from mental constructions, and these constructions are eliminated, dissolved by understanding emptiness. So what binds us and brings out into the samsara is ignorance. And we have to see whether this ignorance can be eliminated or not. So without understanding dependent origination, you will not actually have a very precise understanding of ignorance itself as well. And so, Jai Rinpoche says in Gongpa Rabsel that if you understand how things are merely designated through our conceptions, then you will see how that we actually how this ignorance also comes about. So when you are able to see that this ignorance is something which is distorted view, once you see that, then you can also see that there is always a possibility to develop this knowledge of the reality as opposed to this ignorance. So that and knowledge is an opposite or opposing factor for this ignorance. So far we have been slaves of this ignorance, but if you really look at the root of it, it is distorted, and the object that it perceives is not there at all, even in convention. And therefore, using the reasonings that you find in the Madhyamaka tradition, Madhyamaka texts, you can see that whether it's an experience inside or the objects outside, they appear to have some objective independent existence, and that in turn leads us to have attachment and anger and so forth. We don't need to talk about religion or resort to some scripture to see this fact, but there is an American psychiatrist, his name is Aaron Beck, so he's not a religious person, but he is a psychiatrist, helping people with psychological problems and advising them. And he has written a book which the title says The Prisoners of Hate. So he told me that I had a conversation with him. When we become angry at somebody, the person looks absolutely negative in all respects. The person looks negative, but if you really look closely, he said 90% of that negativeness in the person is our own mental projection. So he's not a Buddhist. He has not studied Madhyamaka tradition, Madhyamaka view and text, but he said this. So this is what he said is very similar to this, what Nagarjuna says. Karma and delusions come from our wrong conceptions. So the karma which brings us into samsara, which is brought about by our negative emotions, and that in turn is brought about by this wrong mentation, inappropriate mentation. So this is exactly what he said is exactly what Nagarjuna also says. So when we, I'm switching over.
When we speak about the attachment and desire is something which is born or by its own nature as faulty, but then again we speak of two desire. Even in terms of bodhicitta, we refer to as two desire. So it's important that we have a certain desire. Without desire, there won't be any moment. And without desire, we won't be able to find even our foods. And if there is no protection, which comes by the anger, then we won't be able to guard ourselves against others. So the anger and the desire tell us that they assist us in surviving. Then if they question us in this way, then how should we answer to it? If without the desire, there won't be any attachment to our body, and when we are sick, we won't take medicine. So the reason why we take medicine when we are sick, it is due to our attachment to our body. So this is a question, and we have to, how we should answer to it, is that is true in that sense and perspective. Looking at the object as a beautiful by the desire is not faulty by itself. But the reason why we object to the nature of the attachment and the desire is that it arises through a causes which looks at the object which is much beyond the reality of all the phenomena or the object. Against we get desire or anger. And it is also explained in the science also that, and it is similar in our text also, that due to the different conceptual thoughts in our mind, which creates the nature of the object that we look at, and due to that, the attachment and the desire arrives, and which bring us continuously to the samsara. And if we answer in this way, there won't be any argument further from the attachment and the desire. And when these conceptual minds, which precedes the anger and attachments, they are the one which derives the anger, and they creates or they creates they create the object in such a way which is against or which is even beyond the nature of that object. So therefore, the highest mathematical schools assertion of even speaking about without having even the slightest inherent existence from the objective side, and such a mind which looks at that object is being refuted by the mathematical school. And even in the desire and the attachment, there are different levels, a subtle one and the gross one. And as these attachments and angers are being drawn by the conceptual mind, and gradually it, through this conceptual mind, these attachments and the desire grows. So in order to eliminate those desires and eliminate, or in order to meditate the antidotes for these opponents, of course we should understand the nature of this mind. Then if you go further to fight against this, and if your enemies becomes even more stronger than you, then you have to run away from it. There is no other way left. So as we say that, even though we know that those afflicted emotions are the real enemy, but how does these afflicted emotions and the deserving minds comes into us? What are their objectives and what are their focus? So we have to contemplate various in detail. So if we analyze and check in this manner, then we will come to know that these are all the nature of all this appearance in our minds are created by the conceptual mind in our mind that precedes those anger and hatred. So if it is something that is based on reasons, and maybe we can draw a distinction here, and maybe the affected emotions are something which is born inherently without not debating about any causes or reasons. And the inherent, those kind of the graspings that comes inherently as a human being, as we are born as human beings. And of course, when you look at, but other than that, those are other graspings which comes through the philosophical reasons. The wrong reasons are all caused and arises due to the different views of the philosophical tenets and the schools. the views of the self as independent and independent, so draws those graspings in ourselves. And of course, automatically we are able to generate a compassionate mind towards our dear ones. And when we speak about meditating on compassion and mercy, we speak about contemplating or training gradually in a process. And automatically, as we know that it comes to our near and the dear ones and the family ones will come automatically. So what we need to be trained is the compassion and those mind towards our enemies and the neutral ones, which need to be accustomed, which needs to be trained for a long duration and time. And understanding and studying about the beneficial effects of the emptiness and the compassion and the bodhicitta. And through such practices and through such valid reasons, the compassion towards all the beings will automatically come to all the beings. And even when we speak about the seven categories of the mind, not just counting the numbers, it's very important that we study their own characters. And as it says that without pondering its origins and how they maintain you in samsara, you will never know how to get samsara's root. So in order to renounce from the samsara, we have to understand what are the causes that bring us to samsara, and is there any antidote to it. So in this way, we will automatically or gradually generate a mind or a conviction within us that there is a possibility within us that liberation is something that which we all can attain. And when we think about the beneficial qualities of liberation, and as I used to say that the Buddha's teaching is to bring happiness to all, not to contemplate on suffering. And the reason that it is for bringing happiness is not just for this life, but even the next and the subsequent lives. And not just for that, even for this life, to have a very contented life with happy and a joyful life. And thinking about the cause and effect in such way will bring more friend in this life also, bring more happiness in this life also. So if you are too self-centered and always you have to stay in a pool of frightened and suspicions, and with the suspicions and the frightening will continue, and which will bring unhealthy and uncomfort to your body, and also your facial expressions will be not smile and unhealthy appearance, which will drive away your friends also. And as you have a calm mind and a peaceful mind, of course, your body and the facial expressions also express in a different way, and that way the friends and everyone will come more towards you. And everyone will feel very comfortable with you. And as I said yesterday, if you feel that you are important, you are considering yourself as important, then there is no possibility that you could make more friends. So in this way, so in order to be happy in this life, it has to come through the practice of Dharma, especially the practice of bodhicitta. In the Mahayana tradition, it is certain that if you practice the beneficial qualities and of the bodhicitta and compassion, that you will get a human rebirth in the next life. And for the long term, there will be the happiness, the ultimate happiness of liberation and enlightenment. And the teaching of the Buddha, in summary, is to generate happiness to all the sentient beings. The reason why I say is that some people may say that the Buddha's teaching is to contemplate or thinking about the sufferings, which is wrong. And maybe many of you know, in the eastern Kham regions in Tibet, I think I didn't tell yesterday, One of my friends who is from Qom told me he is an abbot. Someone came to see the abbot. And that day, the abbot was not present. And the person who came to see asked where the abbot went. And the attendant says that the abbot went to bring fear and frighten the villagers. This is in the early 1960s, sorry. In the 1960s, when we first started the Buddhist, the introduction to Buddhism, and one of the Indian old men whom I met, he told me that he went to the Tibetan library to listen to the introduction to Buddhism. And he speaks about bodhicitta and also the mind to wish a benefit for others. And it's very helpful. And he congratulated and he said it's very helpful. Then he went for another time. And speaking about the hell, and it's speaking about the hot coals and the cold hells, which is too heat and too severe. So I just came out of it. It's not helping me. And when this, normally the villagers, they do not understand about the liberation and the enlightenment. So what they are able to explain is the descriptions of the hell realms, the hell, the cold and the severe heat and the hot hell realms. So this sometimes are used as a means of frightening our devotees and others. So maybe that abbot also do not really understand about the real teachings of the Buddhas. And he used to tell that about the negative karmas, generate negative karmas, and that once if born in the hell, then there will be problems and the difficulties. The real teaching of the Buddha is to generating a pride and happiness from within oneself and practice. It is not that you feel covered or which brings a covertness to you. And those religions and those traditions who speaks about the Creator, but I do not mean disrespect to them. Of course, when I go to the Christian churches and other temples, of course, they have been beneficial to millions and billions of people for the hundred of years, and still they are doing the same. Of course, I have very sincere respect and to all the traditions. It is really different due to the different mindsets and necessary of the people. Of course, it suits to millions of the peoples, and I really respect them as a general. But when we speak from the philosophy point of view, those who believe in the Creator, it seems that there is not much freedom in their own hand, as they relied 100% to the God. And they say that if they do or do something against the wishes of the God as a Creator, then they will be born in the hell. So which means that there is not much freedom. But however, Lord Buddha says that you are the protector of your own. And that everybody has a Buddha nature in themselves, that which we practice further, there is a potentiality in every sentient being that can be a book, can be enlightenment or can be a Buddha one day. So therefore, the teaching of the Buddha is something that we can practice wholeheartedly, practice with a calm mind, practice from one's own side without fear or without the need of frightening or relying upon supernatural powers. So the practice should not be mere kind of a talk that you generally does, but need to contemplate further and deeply in order to realize it. And it is a source of generating and bringing happiness to the immediate and also for the long term. And as I used to say that, as we are under the influence of the karmic, negative karmic actions, and we are under the sufferings, we are undergoing suffering. But in the hearts of heart, we should have a feeling that we have done something, being born as a human rebirth. So even though our body is by nature, which will bring suffering continuously, but in the hearts of heart or your mind should be in such a way way that which will feel proud by itself that it can do something beneficial, it can bring happiness. Cultivate digest, discuss with samsara and renunciation from it and press awareness of what binds to it, even though it's just one verse and one stanza, but it's very powerful. Once your intention to turn away from samsara in its entirety has become as strong as the wish of a person engulfed in the flames of a burning house to escape from it, you will have mastered training or life in the intermediate being's path. So this is training your mind in intermediate being's path. So next is the training the mind on the path of great beings. By cultivating the three higher trainings, you achieve a state of personal liberation. However, such an achievement is insufficient. Once free of samsara, you are no longer obliged to wander in it. Nevertheless, you have neither completely discounted your faults nor acquired all good qualities. Not having fully fulfilled your personal aims, your ability to accomplish others' goals remain limited. Consequently, it is necessary to attain Buddhahood that permits the completion of both goals. As it is said that the bodhicitta is a mind that wish for wish enlightenment for the sake of the others. So therefore, the mind that wishes for enlightenment has to be derived or has to be originated from a mind that wish the happiness for others. And it is also says in the Lamrim that, of course, giving by practicing the generosity in terms of giving clothes and arms to other people is immediate or ordinary ways of the practicing of generosity. But the real walking towards the other or serving other has to come from the means of eliminating the afflicted emotions by itself and the causes and the roots of those eliminating issues. And if you are also under the influence of those afflicted emotions and its latencies, then you are not in a position to be a cause of eliminating such afflicted emotions and other people. Even the arahats who are actually free from afflicted emotions, but still they have the latencies or the imprints left in them, but they are not 100% equipped to liberate other person and bring them to enlightenment. And to be of service to the other persons and the sentient beings, it is very important that we understand their mindset and their necessities. So without understanding those needs of the other persons, as it is says in the teaching on the beneficial of bodhicitta, that we are not able to give teachings on emptiness to any audience or the persons whose mindset is not ripen enough to receive those teachings. So therefore, it is very important to understand the exact needs and the mental states of the persons in order to give them the exact and the appropriate teachings. So therefore, in order to understand the exact appropriate needs of all the sentient beings, it is only the Lord Buddha or the enlightened beings. So even the bodhisattvas who are in the 10th level of the grounds or the states, they are, even though they are in such high state, they are also not able to understand those detailed needs of all the sentient beings. The fact is that in order to understand all these things, one need to be free of even the slightest obscurations that obscure one from understanding everything, or in other words, gaining the omniscient mind. Just praying or supplicating, just praying for yourself that may I become Buddha, it is very difficult that it will be accomplished other than practicing. Buddhahood cannot be achieved solely for personal reasons. It requires concern for the welfare of all sentient beings. Just as you are sunk in an ocean of misery, so too are sentient beings afflicted with suffering and thoroughly wretched. There is not a single sentient being who has not been your father and mother, and these countless times all have cared for you lovingly. To free these kind beings from samsara and establish them in the unsurpassed state, being sorrow without remains. And here the bodhicitta is being to be composed of two minds. And as Khunlo Lama Dzinzin Gyatso Rinpoche says that the bodhicitta mind is something which can fulfill the needs and the wishes of the self, the other, and immediate and the long term. And even for the immediate causes. So if one have even a slight mind of a practice of the bodhicitta, one should be more equipped or ready or in order to counter the problems that face. And if one is already in the path of such practices of the generation of the mind, then of course we can say that one is already in the path of generating or developing the or gaining the ultimate happiness. And in summary, one need to contemplate upon the beneficial qualities of the bodhicitta mind. And Shantideva as stated in the Bodhicitta Avatara, engaging in the deeds of Bodhisattva, about the beneficial effects of the Bodhicitta and the mind that aspire for enlightenment, it is very important that we also strive hard to generate such a mind from the seven cause and 7 point cause and effect. The first, thinking about all the sentient beings as one's brother and remembering their kindness and so on. And also in the second chapter of Paramita, speaks about thinking about the emptiness and also thinking about all the sentient beings as one's mother, father, and relatives. And or other words, thinking about all sentient beings as one's dear and the near ones. And when we speak about mother, of course, we have experience about how kind the mother is for of this life. Then, and similarly, that all the sentient beings, the innumerable number of sentient beings, we have to generate our mind that of even though the sentient beings are numberless, but we should be able to contemplate in that way. And in the second chapter of Paramita, they speaks about whether there is an end to the samsara or not. And in some of the Lamrim teachings says that if the sentient beings are a limit or there is a certain number, then when we think about the different, when we say about the all sentient beings have been your mother for one time or the another, then there is very difficult to prove that. And since the lives are countless, then also the mothers are also countless. And but then if this if there is an end to the samsara, then we have to the number of the sentient beings and the murder also has to be limited, which is quite difficult to digest and understand. And there is a way to also practice the bodhicitta from exchanging self with others. But first, the 7-point cause and effect is more efficient and easy to practice. The first, thinking about all the sentient beings as one's mother, then remembering their kindness, and from there to the compassion that thinks about the sufferings that which wants to liberate all the sentient being from their sufferings, and the extraordinary intent, which is by itself a compassion, and from it the bodhicitta arises. And contemplating about the exchanging of the self and other is very powerful. And as we know that all the sentient beings are same in the sense that they all wish to have happiness and do not wish to have suffering. And all the dear ones and the families of this life are very kind to us. And even though they are very kind to us, even not being as a dear or the family, or in other words, even the enemies of yours are also very kind to you. And the main opponent or the obstacle to generating such a compassion is the anger. And the antidote to anger is tolerance or the patience. And of course, we know that we cannot practice the tolerance or the patience focusing at the Lord Buddha or Nagarjuna or one's master. So we need to practice patience and tolerance. But of course, then the only person to whom we can practice patience is the one which makes you feel angry, so which is your enemies. And Kunalama Rinpoche, while I was receiving the Bodhicharya Avatara's teaching, he told me this story that someone was going to circumambulation towards a temple, and there was someone meditating with the focused mind, with the still body, and someone who's going around him and asks him that, "What are you meditating?" Then he told him that, "I'm practicing patience and tolerance." And the one who's going circumambulations told him, "You should eat sheet." And the one who's contemplating said, "You can eat it, I don't want it." So he was immediately angry. So when there was no one deserving his, when everything was calm, he was practicing tolerance. And when immediately when someone comes to make him angry, his practice of tolerance and patience were lost. So in order to practice patience and tolerance, then of course we need an enemy in front of you or near you to practice it. And in short, in order to practice the bodhicitta, the conditions that you need is the enemies and or those person who criticize you. And so these conditions are very important in order to practice the bodhicitta. So we have to practice those antidotes, focusing on those objects. And when we speak about in the category of the tolerance, that we are not able to answer or reply in the harsh manner to enemies when they bring harm to you. So instead of harming them, we should think about their kindness. And we have to also dedicate the benefits that is generated, merits accumulated out of practicing compassion or the tolerance to your enemies, which makes you feel angry. Or because they are the persons who are responsible for the practice of compassion and the tolerance in you. And when we speak about the importance of enemy, I'm not saying that you should make enemies with other. If you have no enemy, then of course it's the best thing. So when we speak about Buddha's teaching, it is more about the trying to differentiate between the right and the wrong, and the potentiality to understand, the potentiality to analyze and to check. And Lord Buddha has also speaks about 9 different promulgations in Vinaya. So all these promulgations are dependent upon different situations and the different needs at that time. So whatever actions that we perform, we have to understand what are the negative sides and the positive sides, and what are the purposes. And the most important, thinking more about others and trying to bring more benefits towards others. And with such a mind, we should be doing engaging in all our works. And we have to think about the faulty nature of the mind that cherish more important, the self-cherishing mind, and thinking about the beneficial qualities of the bodhicitta. So in summary, in Guru Puja, all these meanings are summarized. And Nagarjuna has also explained very detail in the commentary on the beneficial qualities of bodhicitta. So in this way, we should be able to exchange the self with others, and from it, we will be able to practice the giving and taking, giving one's happiness and taking other people's suffering about oneself. So, and from that onwards, one should be able to really generate a very strong mind that wish benefits for others, that cherish for others' happiness. So once we are able to develop such a strong mind that cherish others' happiness, then one should be have a strong determination that I myself will be the source or will be the cause to bring happiness to those numberless sentient beings and liberate them from their sufferings. To free these kinds of beings from suffering and establish them in unsurpassed state beyond sorrow without remains, I shall generate the supreme aspiration to enlightenment. The seven are recognizing all sentient beings as your mothers, recalling all their kindness, wanting to repay their kindness, seeing them all in a sympathetic light, love and compassion, capable of inducing the superior intention, a pure superior intention, and the spirit of enlightenment from which omniscience arises. This is the set of 7 points. Prior to them, you must meditate on equanimity, the attitude of impartiality towards all sentient beings. If you fall into the trap of bias towards sentient beings, a true recognition of them always your mothers will not arise. And even if you generate some love and compassion, they will be partial. Hence the importance of beginning with meditation on equanimity. This requires first visualizing before you numerous neutral beings who have neither helped nor harmed you in this life, and then meditating as follows. From their point of view, we are equal in that we share the same wish to avoid suffering and the same desire to be happy. From my point of view, they are all close to me, having been my fathers and mothers. I shall maintain a balanced attitude towards them and ever cherishing and helping some while giving others at the distance and harming them. Next, you equalize your attitude towards those who have been close to you in this life and towards those who have harmed you. Then you cultivate an equanimous attitude towards all sentient beings. Since there is no beginning to samsara, there is no beginning to my series of lives. This implies that there is no place where it can be said that I have not taken birth and no single sentient being who has not been my mother. In fact, each being has played that role for me countless times. It is simply because I have changed forms of life that I don't recognize them. In fact, among them all, no one has failed to be my mother and father. Every time that they serve as my parents, just as my father and mother of this life have cared for me, they show me great kindness. How has my present mother manifested her benevolence towards me? When I was still in her womb, she was careful not to move too roughly for fear I might be harmed, and generally she protected me. After I was born, she placed me on a soft bed. She held me up and looked at me with loving eyes. She greeted me with kind smiles, lovingly nourished me with her milk, held me to her warm body, fed me food with her tongue, cleaned my nose with her mouth, and wiped my dirt with her hand. She was more distressed at the thought of my falling slightly ill than of losing her own life. She gave me all the wealth and belongings that she never dared to use for her and that she accumulated without consideration for her own suffering and happiness. In brief, to the best of her ability, my mother protected me from harm. What kindness she had shown me, how she has helped me. Ponder this until you are deeply moved. Taking into consideration those close to you in this life, your father and so on, then those who are indifferent to you, and finally those who have harmed you, think. These people have been my mother's innumerable times. In human rebirths alone, they serve as my mother's countless times, and each time they protected me from harm as my person mother has done. They are so kind in infinite ways that they have provided me assistance. The minds of these mothers who have shown me kindness countless times are now powerless, being half crazed by the demon-like clashes. Their ignorance blinds their wisdom. They cannot see their way to good rebirths and sudden goodness. They have no spiritual guides to steer them to the city of liberation. At every moment, they are destabilized by mystics, tormented. They stagger to as they wander along the fearful cliffs of samsara and of the lower realms. If these helpless beings cannot count on me, their child, who they can they count on? If it is not my responsibility to free these mothers from their suffering, who is it? Nothing will be more shameless and inconsiderate than for me to forsake my kind mothers and seek liberation from samsara just for myself. However, Even if my mother's way to achieve a happy samsaric result like every birth as Brahma or Indra, it will not last. Now I will forsake my personal concerns and do all that I can to free from samsara suffering and to lead to the joy of supreme liberation for all sentient beings who are as infinite as space is infinite. If only I could ensure the happiness of all my mothers who are deprived of happiness, may I ensure them happiness. I will do all that I can to ensure them happiness. If only I could free from suffering all my old mothers who endure suffering, may I free them from suffering. I will ensure that they are free from suffering. I will do so personally, but do I have the necessary capacity? At this point in time, without talking of all sentient beings, I am incapable of freeing from samsara suffering and of bringing to supreme joy even a single sentient being. Yet I have committed myself to doing so, and if I were to give up my pledge, I will fall into the lower realms. Given that only a Buddha has the capacity to free all sentient beings from suffering and to bring them to the state of supreme joy. And we have to think about the beneficial qualities of bodhicitta very often. And we can also take the example from animals. The thinking of animals, for example, even the dogs and the birds, who are a little bit more kind than the rest of them. And we can see that the other animals and their own birds and the dogs also come around them in a playful, in a family kind of relationships. If a dog or a cat is also very fierce and very always barking, then he or she is left alone without any friends to accompany them. So it is evident that even in animals, if they are fearful or not kind towards others, they feel that they are isolated from the rest. So of course they do not have the intelligence as human beings. Then thinking about our human beings, of course we should be even superior and better than the animals. So this is about thinking about the beneficial qualities of bodhicitta. It is not enough to... So regarding the second, page number 133, it is when we speak about six times a day the recitation of the repeated taking prayers. So it's not about the real, not about the six times that we always have to do, or we have to just restrict to six only. That if you have time and leisure, and of course we can do as many in a day. And the eight verses, the mind training is very helpful. And as I told during the Kalachakra teaching in Bodh Gaya, that if you memorize the eight verses of mind training, and if you go from different places for pilgrimage and so on, if you recite it often, it's very helpful. And I also do the same, and it's very helpful to me. And the second precept is, from now onwards, that I won't harm any of the sentient beings. Training and recalling its benefits to inspire enthusiasm for generating bodhicitta. Training and producing it six times to enhance the actual spirit of enlightenment. Training in never abandoning any sentient being for whose sake you generate bodhicitta. As for the first thing, by simply generating bodhicitta, already I become worthy of all gods and men's offerings. 133. Regarding the second, if I were to neglect the aspiration to enlightenment, the maturation effect will be more serious than that of transgressing one of the four major vows of ordination. So I will never give it up until I reach Buddhahood. Consequently, three times a day and three times a night, I will recite the following formula, each time repeating it three times. For the third Since I have generated bodhicitta for the sake of sentient beings, regardless of how they behave on my side, I will never at any time abandon any of them. For the fourth, now therefore once I have generated the spirit of enlightenment to ensure that it does not decline but instead grows stronger, I will endure to accumulate a vast store by making offerings to the jewels and so on. To prevent losing the aspiration to enlightenment in others' lives, you must avoid the four black deeds and implement the four white deeds. The following are the four black deeds. So in life, it's very important that one has to be honest. And if you are honest, the other people will trust you. And if you are trustworthy, then you will get a lot of friends. And we all want a lot of friends and company. And if you are not trustworthy, and if you are not honest, then automatically you will have a lot of enemies. So since we all aspire to have a lot of friends, then it's very important that we ourselves be honest. The second black deed is causing someone to regret the virtue she has done when she had no cause for regret. These two you must refrain from entirely. Its remedy is straight towards the great vehicle. The third black deed is to speak roughly out of anger to those who have generated the aspiration to the great vehicle. This you must avoid at all costs. So whether you are practicing Mahayana teachings or not, as the first verse of the mind training says that whenever you met anyone, so you should have a consideration that all sentient beings are superior and more important than you. And as Nagarjuna also says in the Prussian's garland there, the all sentient beings are even more precious. And may I work for the benefit of the sentient beings, and one should be able to contemplate and think about these days and night. The fourth black deed is being hypocritical and deceitful in your relations with others, which you give all together. You are to be determined to be honest with them. To quote Jeremy Che, bodhicitta is the main beam of the great vehicle. It is the base and foundation for vast activity. Like a philosopher's stone, it converts the two accumulations into gold. It's a mine of merit containing merits of virtue. Having understood this, the hero concursants make the supreme precious aspiration the very call of their practice. I think I will read a little bit more. You may wonder whether it is sufficient to cultivate aspirational bodhicitta alone. Indeed, it is not. On its basis, you are to take bodhisattva vows and train in vast bodhisattva activities. In other words, you are to cultivate the six perfections so as to ripen your own mind and the four ways of collecting disciples to measure others' mind. Among the six, the first is generosity. To practice it motivated by the thought, for the sake of all sentient beings, I shall achieve Buddhahood. You explain the accurate, excellent spiritual path to all those who lack it. You predict those who fear the authorities' war, and so on, and those who are frightened by fearful beings, demons, fierce animals, snakes and like, and by inanimate forces, fire, water, etc. Without hesitation, you provide the poor with food, drink, beds, medicine, and such. And when we practice the first, when we practice the six perfections, as it is very important that we understand the purpose of those practices. In brief, you give without regret your body, belongings, and all your virtue of three times. Generosity, like a wish-granting gem, fulfills beings' hopes. It is the best weapon to cut the knot of stinginess. It is the bodhisattva's practice that inspires unfailing courage. On its basis, their sweet renown spans all ten directions. Knowing this, the wise follow the good path and offer body, goods, and virtue, all without exception. The second is the training in ethical discipline. Thinking for the sake of others, I will realize Buddhahood. To that end, you cultivate remembrance, vigilance, self-respect, and consideration for others. And every time you do something, you must make sure not to perform non-virtue, even at the cost of your life. the last paragraph. To train in patience, think, it is wrong to feel angry with those who have harmed me. For if they harmed me, it is in response to harm that I inflicted upon them in the past. Furthermore, given that they acted completely under the influence of anger, it is not right to harm them in return. Moreover, a single moment of anger destroys the virtue collected over eons and eons by three bases, so I will not let an angry thought arise even in a corner of my mind. This is the patience of enduring harm. Next, reflect when others hurt me and I suffer greatly from it. It serves to lower my pride, arrogance, and so on, and helps me feel disgusted with samsara. When unwanted suffering occurs, it is due to non-virtue, for never could a result arise without a cause. In this frame of mind, avoid non-virtue. By being patient when others harm you, you will fully accomplish the remaining perfection and achieve Buddhahood. To train in the fourth perfection and this wisdom, think, if I fail to meditate discuss with samsara, I will remain attached to the inferior pleasures of physical, verbal, and mental idleness, copulation, sleep, and so on, and will yield to laziness. I must therefore reject these sources of indolence and channel all my energy towards virtuous deeds. In this regard, there is armor patience, which leads you to think, to succor a single sentient being alone, I will not be stopped by any hardship. To quote Jerome Bichi, if you don the armor of unshakably firm and dissuasive, your qualities of knowledge and realization will wax like moon, and all the activities will become meaningful, which dispels every kind of laziness. So we will stop here for lunch break.